David Rudolph, I got it, was trying to make this a very long, drawn-out trial. Kind of the smoke and mirrors idea, like if we keep going in different directions, you're not really going to notice, oh, by the way, there's this beaten woman lying at your feet. But the evidence was very clear.
Well, obviously, we can't know exactly what happened. We have to piece together what we believed happened based on the circumstantial evidence that we've uncovered. The only people that know are Mike Peterson and Kathleen Peterson. And obviously, Mr. Peterson's not going to enlighten us about what he knows. We believe the evidence, at least our evidence, is going to show that she was beaten, that she was stunned and was bleeding, that she probably recovered and struggled in the doorframe with Mike Peterson to a degree, and that he then had to bludgeon her multiple occasions after that, and that she basically bled to death.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today remotely is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard, and author of the book Policing Domestic Violence.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague and where I will be casting his episode very soon.
Yes. We are here with our continuing coverage of the Netflix original series, The Staircase. And we've been talking a little bit about the victimology, learning as much as we could about Kathleen Peterson, the person who died in this case, giving her her voice back, getting to know her. And that's something we didn't really get to do much in the course of that series.
We certainly didn't. I mean, there were very few moments for Kathleen, and that was something that I felt strongly about, and I know that you both did too. There were plenty of opportunities for them to have sort of showcased Kathleen and who she was and what her life was about, but that didn't happen. I think Candice just does a fantastic job of articulating exactly who Kathleen was, and Caitlin has when talking about her mother too.
And it's interesting, though, how the documentary series kind of paints Candice, right? I mean, it makes it seem as though she is sort of a relentless zealot, extremist. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, it does.
Sorry. I understand her being a fierce advocate for her sister. And there are, I mean, just rewatching the series this morning, I mean, she did allow the documentarian to go out with her to see Kathleen's grave, and they go to Duke Library to do some research on their own. So they had a little bit of access to her, but I completely understand her ferociousness as it's depicted in here. I mean, obviously there are two sides that are trying to win.
Yeah, but to set a context, and this is important, is that when her husband, she picked up the phone when Michael Peterson called, because he called all of the family members. And he asked to speak to Mark, her husband, which she thought was very odd, but then wondered whether it was a financial thing because of their financial problems. Mm. And then it was Mark that told her that Kathleen was dead and that she'd fallen down the stairs. Now, she was shocked by that. And of course, she goes to the house, and then she's even more shocked by seeing all the blood. She just didn't expect to see that. But it was the other siblings. It was actually Steve, her brother, and Laurie, who, when they were told what had happened, they both said... Laurie basically said he did this to her. He didn't love her. That was Laurie's immediate reaction. And Steve Hunt equally said Michael Peterson did it. They were the two who felt right from the start that he had something to do with it, and Candice didn't. And so, you know, the fact that Candice, and the same with Caitlin, they were actually very sympathetic to him at the beginning, but it was when they saw the autopsy report and when they saw the crime scene pictures that's when they changed their mind. Mm. And I just want to go back to the part, I mean, I think it was in Beyond Reasonable Doubt, actually, where there's the interview with Michael Peterson, and he basically says this: there are people who think that I did it, and there are people that think that I didn't. And those people in both camps will never change their mind. And he keeps going on about that, but that's not the case, because Candice and Caitlin were fully supportive of him to start with. They didn't think that he did it. It didn't even enter their heads that he had anything to do with it. up until the point they saw all the blood and the autopsy. And actually it was Candice who said the district attorney, Jim Harding, gave her a copy of the autopsy and the pictures and talked her through it.
Right.
And that's the thing that changed her mind. And then all these other things started to fall into place.
Well, so I think this,
I agree with you, Jim. I think they made her look like the villain of the piece in parts. And I thought it was a very strong, you know, when she gave her impact statement mm-hmm. and she made the point that, you know, David Rudolph didn't get Kathleen's name right at the start. You know, I agree with her. If you're going to talk about a victim or someone in death, make sure you get their name right. And the fact that she felt they were trying to intimidate her all the time, when as a family member, she just wants to find out what happened to her sister. She's trying to be an advocate.
Right.
But they're turning the lens on her. And we did hear Michael Peterson utter a number of horrible things yes. about her.
But that's, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know, the documentary shows that. And if they were completely biased, they wouldn't have shown her railing against David Rudolph and the documentary. So,
well, like in Making a Murderer, when they talk about Stephen Avery's criminal history up front, that you think that they're being up front, and then you find out he actually threw a cat into the fire.
Right. Well, I'm just telling you what I've just watched this morning is, you know, not so nice things that they're showing. I mean, they show Michael saying nasty things about her. So that's not a benefit for him.
Unless what it does is when people are on his side already, it makes them want to be more on his side against her. But I think this is a perfect segue, Laura, because you mentioned it so many times, so many things that are in the autopsy report were not in the documentary series and really were not discussed at all. And you would think that would be the pivotal forensic information that was shared, but unfortunately, it was kind of not shared.
That's right. It was brushed over, really, and Dr. Radish's determination. It was relatively short, wasn't it, in terms of what we were exposed to. She's done over 3,200 autopsies. She's very well respected as a forensic pathologist. And, you know, her manner of death and cause of death, well, the manner of death, of course, was determined as homicide, but the cause of death was blunt force trauma, and she believed that blood loss did play a part. But perhaps we should talk through some of the other aspects, because I think it's the fracture of left thyroid cartilage. I don't remember whether that was discussed on the staircase, was it?
I think the only thing I have written down, and that it was very much towards the end of the show, is that the DA's summary was that the defendant was alone in the house with the victim. There were 7 lacerations, fracture with associated hemorrhage of the left thyroid cartilage, consistent with strangulation. And so I would like to discuss, I mean, the most important findings of an autopsy report are the cause and manner of death. So the medical examiner determined that it was a homicide, that a person caused the death of another person, not accidental, not suicide, not natural, not undetermined, but a homicide. And what is that based on? It's based on the number of lacerations on the head and the other subcutaneous hemorrhages and the fracture of the thyroid cartilage.
Well, there were 34, Jim, 34 bruises, marks, contusions on her body.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah.
But what's critical to me is that she said the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. I don't believe there's a foundation for that particular cause of death in this autopsy report, because blunt force trauma to the head that is resultant in death typically is very extreme. The skull is fractured and smashed and brain is hemorrhaging and all of that. And that's not what we have in this case. We have really what amount to superficial wounds to the head. The lacerations and avulsions to the head were not through into the skull. In other words, there wasn't an axe that was gone through the scalp and into the skull and into the brain. There were major cuts on the head. So those cuts bled. And to me, I would think that the cause of death should have been exsanguination due to blunt force trauma to the head, as opposed to the trauma itself causing the death. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, she does say that at the end of the autopsy report.
But it's not in her pathological diagnosis.
Yes.
And that's just, that summary just doesn't match with what she found in the autopsy.
Yeah, so the summary right at the end is her last paragraph is, in my opinion, the cause of death in this case was due to severe concussive injury of the brain caused by multiple blunt force impacts of the head. Blood loss from the deep scalp lacerations may have also played a role in her death. The number, severity, locations, and orientation of these injuries are inconsistent with a fall down the stairs. Instead, they are indicative of multiple impacts received as a result of beating.
Right. If the severe concussive injuries caused the death, then why isn't there major hemorrhage of the brain?
Right. So this is what our listeners have such a hard time with, and this is why this case is so just stymieing, because it doesn't point to really one thing or the other.
Well, it does, but other things point mm-hmm. to it. And so the brain did not show any contusions or subdural hemorrhage. To me, that is abjectly contrary to her conclusion. Two paragraphs later, she's saying that the cause of death was due to severe concussive injury of the brain. However, the brain does not show any contusions or subdural hemorrhage. Those two things are absolutely inconsistent. And so I don't know. I mean, if I was the defense attorney, I would have just raked her over the coals for that one. But on the other hand, you see, any human being can see the vast amount of blood that's on the floor and walls. That came out of her body. That's exsanguination to me. Yeah. And that, I believe, should have been listed as the cause of death. Now, her interpretation, this medical examiner's interpretation, and she's done thousands of autopsies, probably not a huge amount on homicides, but she's done thousands of autopsies and she should know her stuff. So if she determines that it was from beating, that's okay. But I believe that when Dr. Lee came in, and I totally side with him, that it is completely within the realm of possibility that she could have sustained those injuries that we see on her head and scalp from her head striking the steps or the molding on the side of the stairway or the molding at the bottom of the floor of the stairway, that all of those things could have caused those injuries. However, I also believe that the contact with those objects, the stairs, the molding, and the wall and the floor, all of that could have been done by someone else.
Right, that pulling her back or pushing her?
Yes. Well, if she's on that staircase, right, it's very easy for somebody to yank someone backwards. And then the point of contact could very well be the head, and that could sustain all the impact. But again, something like that, I believe, if that particular thing, falling from a distance, happened repeatedly, I believe there would be indications and there would be absolutely contusions and subdural hemorrhages of the brain. And that did not happen. So, for example, let's go back to shaken baby syndrome, right? This is when a child usually gets brought to an ER listless and not responsive, and then they pass away and they do an autopsy and they look at the brain and it has bounced around back and forth in that skull, causing major contusions and subdural hemorrhages. That led to the death. That caused the death. In this case, you have none. And I just don't understand how that's consistent with either being beaten to death or falling repeatedly from a height of however tall she was, adding a couple of steps to it.
It just never occurred to Michael Peterson that people wouldn't believe him when he said she fell down the stairs. That's really what this is all about. He thought he'd get away with it.
So she was 5'2". She was tiny in stature, by the way.
Okay, so 5'2", and she falls backwards. Maybe she was on the second or third step. Steps are usually 7 to 9 inches high. So we're talking less than a couple of feet. So it wasn't like she fell from 20 feet or 30 feet. She fell from a couple of feet from a standing position. Now, if she did get her head banged against the floor and started bleeding, and she was held down, let's say, by a hand around the throat, what the autopsy found was that there was a fracture with a hemorrhage of the superior cornu of the left thyroid cartilage. So that, as the prosecutor said in her summation, is consistent with strangulation. Now, the pathologist did not include that in her diagnosis of the cause of death. And I think that's very strange. First of all, that fracture occurring, especially in light of the fact that Michael said she's still breathing, she just stopped breathing, and we know that there is evidence of a fracture in her neck area consistent with strangulation. Those three things together, I think, should have been part of this diagnosis. I mean, of course, the pathologist has to deal with the facts that the body tells her, but she also gets to talk to the cops to find out what other circumstances surround this so she can put the facts that she sees in context. In other words, if you see a major smashing of the skull and it's just the person is laying dead on their front stoop, you might think, oh, they fell and smashed their head on a stoop. But if you find out there's a car on top of her, that makes it a difference, right? The car hit her and smashed her into the stoop. That's a logical conclusion then. And the pathologist is allowed to use those outside facts. So it's not they're not just locked into what's in the body or on the body. So I think those facts, the fact that he said she's still breathing, and we know what time that was, and she stopped breathing, and we know what time that was.
Yeah, so that's 2:40 that he calls when he says she's still breathing.
Right, and so it must be like within 7 or 8 minutes later that he calls back and says she just stopped breathing. And so we know that time period of when she stopped breathing. And the fact that we have evidence that there was a fracture of her left thyroid cartilage, that could very well be how she actually died.
Right. And that injury, Jim, is relatively common in car crashes when somebody has a car accident and or strangulation. So, right. You know, again, it narrows it down. I mean, again, that in particular, we will come to the owl theory, but there's no way an owl did that, right?
If she was strangled, wouldn't there be, like Jim, I had asked you before about her pupils or her eyes? And
petechiae occur because blood that is traveling up into the head through the carotid arteries and down through the jugular vein is cut off. So both the carotid arteries and the jugular vein are cut off. So it's almost like if you have a balloon and you grab it in the middle and you squeeze the bottom of it, the top of it gets bigger. You're forcing air from one section to the other. Well, petechiae happen when you're forcing blood that's in the head, when you're forcing it out. You're putting pressure on both the carotid artery and the jugular vein, and it doesn't allow blood to be then pushed down into the body. It's all trapped in the head. And so it pops out in these tiny little capillaries in your eyes, and you get
these burst blood capillaries. You can sometimes see it in someone's eyes or in the back of their throat or on their chest with strangulation or asphyxiation.
Right. So you'll see those things. But if she's already bled out to a great degree, there may not be enough blood in the head to cause those. So I do believe there's some slight indication of them, but nothing that would absolutely point to strangulation. And I believe that's because of the huge amount of blood loss in this case. There wasn't enough blood present in the head to create that. And there probably wasn't enough need to strangle her too much because she had so much blood loss.
Or in a fit of rage, he goes for her throat. And then she breaks away, runs up the stairs, and he pulls her back, and that's how she falls. I mean,
that's all possible. I mean, we don't know. But what you're describing mm-hmm. is consistent with what I see in this autopsy report. Now, I'm not a medical examiner, but I have reviewed many, many hundreds of these, if not thousands. And I've been trained in what this means. And to me, I don't understand how this ME could have said that she died of blunt force trauma to the head, that that was the cause of death. The trauma caused her death when there was no associated trauma to the brain.
Finding red neurons in someone's brain tissue tells you that the person had an episode of lack of oxygen at least 2 to 4 to 6 hours before they actually suffered whole body death. The conclusion is she was attacked, she was beaten, but then she lived for a long enough period of time for these red neurons to show up or develop by the time she died.
There are other points that are worth highlighting, which is, and she does give testimony to this, of the scratches, 3 scratches over her right eyebrow, 3 bruises on her right eyelid. And she says they couldn't be from an impact from a flat surface because the surrounding bone or protrusion of the nose or the chin would protect mm-hmm. those areas.
Right.
So that interests me, along with no evidence that she aspirated, no blood in the lungs or expelled blood. So my question right. was about Dr. Lee's experiments, mm. you know, with the ketchup, why he did that when the autopsy says there wasn't any sign of blood in her lungs or that she had expelled blood.
Right. But Laura, you make a good point, and this is something that I've discussed with him as well, is that his test was not aspirating ketchup into his lungs and then coughing it out. His test was having ketchup in the mouth and coughing it out, right?
Right, right.
So there's a difference, right? And I think that's exactly what, if that blood spatter is from that type of activity, that is not aspirating blood, that is filling the mouth with blood and then blowing it out.
But still, what are the chances of that? I mean, that amount of blood, that none of it came out of her nasal cavity, none of it got into her lung. I mean, I don't know.
I don't get it. I don't get it. No. Like I said, I'm not convinced that that is what happened. Because of the viscosity of blood, blood tends to droplet rather than spray. In other words, it wants to stick together as a liquid, right? It's not very thin. And that viscosity can tell us the velocity of how the blood was traveling. So little tiny, tiny little droplets of blood that you can see are traveling fairly rapidly. From a gunshot wound, blood that spatters off a gunshot wound, it's really high velocity and it could be microscopic. You can't even see it with the naked eye. That's how small the droplets are. And that's how fast those droplets of blood are traveling. So they get smaller and smaller and smaller the faster they go. So the ones that are on the wall are visible by the eye, and there are some that look like spray, right? So it does make sense that there's some propulsion behind them. And a cough and a sneeze can make particles travel at a very high rate of speed, which is why they would be small. So that part of it is consistent with what Dr. Lee says. However, I don't understand, other than her face being put down in a pool of blood, and then she drinks it into her mouth and then rolls over and sprays it onto the walls. I just don't understand how that happens.
Right. Well, remember, she does have a footprint, his shoe print, on the back of her leg,
mm-hmm.
which would imply she's been turned over.
Right.
Because the way she's found is very bizarre, like the way she's slumped.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's horrible looking. Oh. And her mouth is open. In those pictures that I've seen, her mouth is open. Is that significant at all? Do you see that a lot? I mean, I have no idea.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, because actually, Lisa, when somebody dies, there are all sorts of things that happen. You know, the hands can tighten up into the pugilistic stance and you can have restrictions on different muscle groups. So it's hard to say what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Certainly somebody gasping for air could have their mouth open.
Oh.
One thing, though, Lisa, that I don't know is whether or not the EMTs actually intervened. What they're supposed to do when they respond to a scene is the first thing they do is open an airway and check the pulse. Do you know if that happened?
I believe from what I read, certainly in Diane Fanning's and listening to the paramedics, they both given interviews. I think they determined that she was dead on arrival.
Her eyes were open.
So I'm not sure whether they went to the next step or not. They didn't say whether they tried CPR.
There's a procedure they have to do no matter what, right?
Yes. They're supposed to open the airway by putting two fingers under the neck usually and lifting up the neck so the chin jumps forward. They open the airway and then they check for the pulse. And that's how they're supposed to make the determination that she's dead and that they don't have to do any intervention.
Well, not from what I've read, that wasn't a detail that they talked about. So it's difficult to know whether they obviously moved her, changed things, you know, in terms of any form of intervention that they gave at the time.
Because her pictures tell a story, and I just don't know if that story is accurate. And I'm sure that the jury saw those horrifying pictures of her in situ on the steps. And when I look at that, I have a whole other narrative in my mind, and it's may or may not be accurate.
What do you mean? I mean, what?
When you look at, like I said, like I just said, like it looks like she's in gasping for air. She's in such pain and maybe it's not.
Well, she probably had been. I mean, that's why I'm saying if it took her 2 to 4 hours to die, the brain cells die, but the red neurons burn, then that probably was the situation because we do have a window of two hours and 30 minutes. I think that there is a time issue here and the amount of blood that there was, and the paramedics did say, Jim, that most of the blood was congealed.
Right.
It had when already they got dried.
There. Right. And you mentioned red neurons. So red neurons are found in a brain that has experienced a period of time with low blood flow or no blood flow. In other words, time has elapsed from the bleeding events before she stops breathing. That means that she was still alive for at least a couple of hours after she got the head injury.
Ugh.
So does that mean that she fell and 2 hours later, Michael found her and she was still breathing, and she died then, like he said, when he was on the phone to 911. That's a plausible theory, except for one thing. How did she get this fractured left thyroid cartilage?
And that can't be from a fall.
It's highly unlikely it is, because it's normally, as I mentioned, it's common in car crashes with a seatbelt around someone's neck. And the second is strangulation. And strangulation is the number one cause of domestic violence, homicide, primarily, not exclusively, but a male putting a hands around a female neck.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you do tend to see it. The owl theory is a big problem because an owl, in my belief, there's no way an owl could do that. And the other aspects that I found interesting that we haven't mentioned was just around the defensive wounds as well on her hands and wrists, which she does have a lot of injuries, 34 bruises, marks and contusions. Now, if, as Jim said, if this is happening and Michael Peterson's outside, for example, his version is that he may have been outside for an hour. And I've had a number of back and forths on Twitter with people saying it's highly likely he could have been out there wearing shorts in December, even though it was something like 12 degrees and people from North Carolina.
I've heard it's 53 degrees. So there's even more controversy.
Yeah. Celsius or Fahrenheit were tweeting me to say that, you know, a lot of people in December do wear shorts in North Carolina. But the challenge is that we're talking about at night when it's colder and he was by water and he claims that he was asleep out there for an hour or 2 hours when it's you know, you're by stagnant water, you are immobile. And I haven't got this confirmed, but Candice basically said that there wasn't any furniture out by the pool. So if that report is right, that he's standing, sleeping, smoking his pipe, wearing his shorts, and he goes back in, you know, an hour plus later and finds her and then calls the police.
Well, we have so much to discuss about the Netflix original series, The Staircase. But till next time, signing off for Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.